pleasure to be here again. My name is Neil Franklin. Retired from the Maryland State Police, former colonel of Baltimore City, current executive director of the Police Law Enforcement Action Partnership. And we have a little tagline, which is Advancing Justice and Public Safety Solutions. Not reform, solutions. There's a difference. So I'm going to tell you a little bit more about me, a little bit more about our organization, some of the issues that we cover, some of the things that we deal with, and from listening, you know, to the conversations from some of the folks running for office, first of all, Thomas, my heart goes out to you, your cousin. I get it, as you'll see. You know, in listening to you, you talk, it's almost like I might be preaching to the choir here when it comes to drug policy and where we should go and some of the things that we should be doing. So I'm going to talk a little bit about that, but first let me tell you a little bit about the organization. But before I do that, I'm trying to... here it is. No, not that one. JD, when you get elected, can you take care of this for me? It's a red light ticket from Baltimore County. Absolutely. It's the second notice I got for this damn thing. I'm refusing. I'm trying to hold off. I just really don't want to pay it. I don't think it's right. I hope you get elected real soon. They're going to take my tags, I know, if I don't deal with this, but I'm just keeping it in my pocket so that it, anyway, it stays fresh in my mind and so on. But anyway, Sean, Libertarian. sorry guys, I'm on my second cup of coffee here tonight, and it doesn't take much for me. And somebody told me earlier that maniacs drink it black, or what did you say? What psychopaths drink it black? For the record, I did put some cream in it at the table there, so. A little bit about LEAP, our organization. We're an international nonprofit organization of criminal justice professionals. Now, police officers, we throw judges in there too, even though they're judicial, you know, three branches of government. Prosecutors, parole and probation, corrections, prison wardens. Our board chair is the superintendent of a jail in Chester County, New Hampshire. What else? Federal agent, and so on. So we're a speakers bureau, and we speak about the failed war on drugs. And it's not just failed. It's actually counterproductive to public safety. The one thing that we like signed up for in our profession, to improve public safety, it's counterproductive to it. And so we created a speakers bureau. Now, it was formed in 2002 by two police officers, a guy by the name of Jack Cole, who's a retired lieutenant from the New Jersey State Police, and another guy by the name of Peter Crick, who's the captain of a small-town police department in upstate New York. And we've spent our speakers and spent, you know, a good portion of our careers on the front lines of the war on drugs. In all those different disciplines, we had something to do with it. As a judge, convicting people who have been charged with these crimes. Obviously, as police officers, first contact, making the arrest, and charging prosecutors, charging people with drug crimes. You know, even parole and probation, where we've gotten to this place that when someone's on parole and probation, and you know what, their urine's a little hot, a little dirty, when they go in for their regular drug test, you know what happens? They go back in. In the conversation earlier today, talking about addiction, and the stigma. See, there's two types of stigma we place on people. You know, first of all, if you're addicted, something's morally wrong with you. You're morally bankrupt. Come on, folks. How many of you are free of addiction? Gambling? Booze? Drugs? Tobacco?
Coffee.
I saw you out there smoking. This is mine. Coffee? If I don't have it, I get a headache. Mountain Dew, caffeine, same thing in here. You know, sex? Okay, that's probably most of you in here. Not me, I've gotten over it. So, does that mean that we're morally bankrupt? No, it doesn't. So that's one type of stigma. The other is when we criminalize. So I speak this bureau, and I speak as we have thousands of members around the globe. We have branches in six other countries outside of the U.S. And again, we have a speakers bureau of about 200. You know, these are the folks that are vetted, the folks that volunteer their time to go out, travel around, and speak on this issue. And one of the things, a big problem we have in this country, is that we really like to arrest people and put them in jail. I mean, it's evident. If you look at the numbers, when you compare us to other countries, we're the number one jailer on the planet. Freedom. The land of the free. Home of the brave. This is supposed to be the place, when someone says liberty or freedom on this planet, most people would think about the United States. Then why do we jail so many people? Why have we imprisoned so many people? Prior to the war on drugs, which, you know, even, look, when Richard Nixon in the 1970s declared a war on drugs, public enemy number one, substance abuse, his budget for fighting this was weighted more in treatment, a lot of people don't know that, than enforcement. But as time went on and the different administrations came in, it doesn't matter whether it was from the right or from the left, it became this thing of public safety where they attached it to drug use and these drug crimes, and every administration got tougher. And they made it, you know, this big media campaign about public safety. If we want to improve public safety, we got to lock up those degenerates that are using drugs. Not the drugs we like alcohol. I mean, this is Congress and, you know, but heroin, cocaine, marijuana, those drugs. You know, the drugs that the other people use, right? Each administration as they went along. In the 1960s, before the war on drugs, our rate of incarceration in this country was equal to that of our European brothers and sisters. And right now, when you look at NATO, the closest country to us in incarceration rate is the UK, 147 per 100,000 citizens. 147 per 100,000 citizens. Anyone like to guess where we are?
25%
of our population. So, we have 25% of the world's imprisoned population. You're there. Our number is 714 per 100,000. Now, remember, the closest to us is the UK. 147. That's a problem, folks. In the 1960s, we were on par. 1970s, we started going up a little bit. We hit the 1980s, and it goes vertical. 1960s, we had about 400,000 people in prison in this country. And recently, we've gone up as high as 2.3 million. We're down around 2.1 million right now. Because the war on drugs, to the war on people. You can't have a war on drugs.
It's like having a war on this microphone, right?
Well, I know a little bit.
you know a little bit about that? So this microphone, it just is. It's going to sit there until I do something with it. Now, if I turn it on and start speaking words of hate, start inciting riots through it, you might want to prohibit microphones. You see what he did with that microphone? He started a damn riot. Let's prohibit microphones. But if I turn it on and I start speaking words of life through it, right? If I start speaking words to grow the Libertarian Party through it, right? Well, depending on who you are, it might be a good or a bad thing. But, you know, for this group, it's a good thing. You might want to, you know, buy more microphones. Right? So it's really all about the environment that we create for drugs that's going to make a determination whether they're good or bad or somewhere in between. Policies of prohibition have created an environment, guys, probably the worst that we could have done as relates to public policy. So our organization speaks out about this. We equate it to alcohol prohibition. Guys, remember that? Anybody? Alcohol prohibition of the 1920s only lasted 13 years. Why did it only last 13 years? Because the people who put it in place, when they did so, they were able to see the tremendous harm that they added on to alcoholism. And then, you know what? They still had alcoholism at high rates. Well, it really weren't that high, but to them, they still had it. But what happened when they entered into this world of prohibition? Drive-by shootings. Well, first of all, alcohol became very profitable for organized crime and gangsters, right? So you had your drive-by shootings, you had your running gun battles, you had kids being recruited by bootleggers, you had bad booze flowing through the streets, no quality control measures, bathtub gin is referred to. You had corruption. Corruption just started going through the roof. And something very, very important happened also. The murder rate in this country started to soar. And it kept going up for those 13 years until they realized that they'd made a mistake. Now, you're talking about doing away with a constitutional amendment because they had to amend, and this is something for you guys to remember. You see, they had to put forth an amendment to institute alcohol prohibition. Why? Does anybody know why?
Government had no business right.
Absolutely.
Not a delegated power of the Constitution.
Absolutely. So they couldn't pass a federal law to affect all of the states regarding this. There's the 10th Amendment. You know what the 10th Amendment's about? Somebody, come on, someone. You gotta know. I hope you guys know. Say it. Go ahead, keep going. Absolutely. So some people refer to it as states' rights. That's a simple way to put it. So, you know, does the federal government have the right to invoke a law that's going to affect the rights of the state? And they couldn't do it. The only way that they could pass a law to deal with the interstate transportation of alcohol, but that was as far as they could go. But to prohibit it, they needed a constitutional amendment, the 18th Amendment. Now, do you know how difficult it is to undo an amendment? Extremely difficult. But the problems of prohibition were so severe, and everyone who was alive got to see that change, so they did away with the 18th Amendment. They repealed it. So you wonder, how can they implement federal drug laws today? And that's why you'll see legislation on Capitol Hill now regarding the 10th Amendment and drug policy. They're challenging it. And they should be. We should be. So, alcohol prohibition was a huge failure. But we repeated the same mistakes when we entered into this place of prohibiting drugs. Now, I'm not going to get into the history because we only have a short period of time. But I'm not going to get into the real history about drug prohibition and how we got here. Just know that the policies exist and are very, very problematic as it relates to what we're interested in, and that's public safety. So I'll come back to the organization and some of the things that we're going to do, that we're trying to do. But let me tell you a little bit about myself, because as an organization, we speak to ending drug prohibition. We speak to legalizing, regulating, and controlling all drugs. And we do that for a number of reasons. Obviously, public safety. Okay, why should we have policies in place that the cartels agree with? The cartels do not want us to end drug prohibition because they're making a lot of money. A lot of money. Our gangs and crews in our own neighborhoods and communities don't want it to end. They're making a lot of money. And the violence that comes from that is unbelievable. Cities like Baltimore, Chicago, New York, you name it, any major city across this country is dealing with drug prohibition violence, territorial control of these gangs and crews. And then when you have a shooting from someone trying to encroach on someone else's territory, then you have retaliation going back and forth, back and forth, back and forth for months, sometimes years. It was violence that got me to this place. It was violence. We all have our individual stories as law enforcement folks as to what made you see this differently. Because let me tell you, folks, when I was a state trooper, I locked up a lot of people. A lot of people, mostly for marijuana possession. If you look at my raw numbers of arrests for drugs, most of them are for marijuana possession. Not that many are for what we call, you know, major dealers, kingpins. Actually, I personally, and I spent a lot of time in drug enforcement, I never ever arrested a kingpin. And, you know, in the way I've arrested dealers, but never someone at the pinnacle, the top of this organization. Now, we've arrested some, but you're not going to find many, if any, around today. We busted up a lot of organizations, and now everybody's just a free agent out there running crazy, right? You know where to go. You run up to New York. You run to wherever. You grab a package. You come back, and you set up shop, and you just start slinging the stuff. You know, you got a small crew. You arm them with some handguns or whatever, AK-47, MAC-10s, and you say, go out there and sell this stuff. Who do they hire? They hire a lot of kids. A lot of kids. Violence got me to this place. Back in the year 2000, I'd retired from the Maryland State Police by then. That was the year after I retired. And most of that career that I had in the state police, I worked undercover, I commanded drug task forces. I was talking earlier, I had all the task forces on the Eastern Shore of Maryland. And for those of you who don't know, Cecil County is on the Eastern Shore. And I had Harford County as well. And now I'm responsible for a lot of people being arrested through these task forces. When I retired, there was a good friend of mine by the name of Ed Totley. Ed Totley was a state trooper. He was working undercover. He was working with the FBI in Washington, D.C. on a major cocaine case. He was buying cocaine from this guy. He was going to make the last buy of cocaine on October 30th, 2000. It's the nature of such a business when it's illegal. You see, because when you get ripped off as a drug dealer, well, you're going to run to the police and say, I got robbed? Right? No, you can't. So it makes sense
as other bad guys. We call them stick-up boys and everything else, but it makes sense to rip each other off whenever you can. This guy decided he was going to rip Ed Totally off that night. He's going to keep his dope, and he was going to take Ed's money, state's money, that he was buying for, $2,000. But in the nature of this business, because I spoke before earlier about retaliation, you know, if you're going to rip off somebody in this business, you might want to consider doing away with it so that they can't come back at you. That's what he did. He didn't know Ed was a cop. Starting was another drug dealer. And he shot him at point-blank range in the side of the head that night. And it made me and some others, just a couple, in our circle, start thinking about this, right? I was with Baltimore City now, and as I started thinking about what happened to Ed, within a short period of time, we had two Baltimore City police officers killed by drug dealers in the city. I also thought about a guy back in the 1980s, a detective with Baltimore City, Marnie Ward, Marcellus Ward, who was killed in a similar circumstance as Ed was. The drug dealer just went bad. And then 2 years to the month after Ed was killed, a family of seven in Baltimore City was killed by one drug dealer in one night, the Dawson family, because the mother was working with the police, as we want good citizens to do, right? Tell us who they are. We'll come in and get them. We'll surgically remove them from your community. Yeah, and then the next day you've got others fighting for that vacant piece of real estate. But that's what she was doing. He found out about it and set their home on fire one night to send a message. This is what drug prohibition policy, not drug use, drug prohibition policies do. So by that time, I started speaking out about this. And I started speaking officially for LEAP in 2008, became the director, left law enforcement altogether just to become the director of this organization in 2010, speak about these issues. Since then, I've been learning about mass incarceration, how we just think about this. I'm a cop, not just a cop. I've been a major for the Maryland State Police, a colonel with the Baltimore Police Department, a lieutenant and a major with Maryland Transit Police. And all the time, I'm you know, in Baltimore City, I'm the head of training. As I said, Maryland State Police, drug enforcement, criminal investigation, and head of training. Maryland Transit, drug enforcement again, head of the Detective Bureau. And all this time, I had no idea how many people were locking up in this country. So you know, the rank and file members don't have a clue. I mean, I've been to all these schools, Johns Hopkins and all these other places, leadership training and this, that, and not once do they talk about this or teach you about this. And so you think you're out there doing good for the community. Look, I'm not thinking about that. I'm not even thinking about what you guys are talking about, which is liberty, you know, our freedom. But as time goes on, and you know, now I'm speaking for LEAP, I'm running the organization, and I find myself, you know, now being called and asked to speak for Students of Liberty. And I'm starting to hear this. I got a bunch of stuff in my pockets. I love pockets. And I start hearing this message, right? I'm like, Libertarian Party, who are these cats? I thought there were only two. Democrats and Republicans, what's this stuff? So now I'm hearing about the Libertarian Party and these principles. So now I go back and say, wow, you know, that thing I took an oath for, you know, the Constitution of the United States to uphold and protect it, you know, reading that, wow, we really screwed up. And not only that, the work that I've been doing for 34 years is counterproductive to the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. It goes completely against a lot of that. I mean, again, going back to the freedoms that we're supposed to have, right? The war on drugs is attacking our freedoms, our liberty in this country, more than any other single piece of public policy. more than many of them combined. So let's touch on those for just a second. Just a second. Civil forfeiture. Does that ring a bell with anyone? I mean, I see a lot of head shaking, some yeses. Some of you know there's only two types of people when it comes to civil forfeiture. Okay? Those who hate it, and I mean hate it, and those who don't know what it is. It's only two. Once you learn what it is, you hate it. Civil forfeiture, where me, the government, police, can literally take your property, take your money, and not charge you with a crime. To make you, you see, here's the thing. I suspect, not probable cause, I suspect that your money, you know, the $5,000 I find in your car when I pull you over because you told me you got $5,000 in your car, that you're going to buy this wonderful, this, you know, this used car for your child or for yourself or whatever. So you gotta take cash. You're bringing cash. Oh yeah, true, bro. I got $5,000. I'm going to buy this. That's my $5,000, man. I think this money is guilty of being used to facilitate a crime, or derived from a crime, or tools of criminal activity. So you can bring your attorney back down here to North Carolina or wherever, Texas, and prove otherwise. But right now it's mine. Here's your receipt. Totally legal until we change those policies. Now, the reason I'm attaching this to the war on drugs is because this really came about under Reagan in the 1980s when we were going after this drug kingpin. Okay, yeah, I kind of get it. Since we're enforcing these laws, since we have these laws in place, let's go after the kingpin, the top of the pyramid. Let's take everything they've got and turn it over to the state, to the government. We ran out of kingpins. But we didn't stop using these policies of civil forfeiture. Now, if we catch you, and even, okay, I gave you one example. But suppose I do stop you. Look, if you have a half a joint in your car, or maybe, you know, you could have even bought a used car and they find a half a joint in the trunk as they're snooping around. You take the car, take whatever cash you have on you, whatever. And this is happening every day, quite a bit every day across this country. Civil forfeiture policy. Another example. Baltimore City just had a Department of Justice investigation. They examined, like, I think it was like a 4.5 year period where they looked at the stops. So they started going through records to examine the stops of people being stopped on the street. And they came up with a little over 300,000 pedestrian stops in the city. Of those 300,000 stops, where me, the police, were stopping people, 3.7% a ticket or an arrest was made. 3.7%. What about the other 96.3% of those stops where people were being stopped on the street, you know, searched, not permitted to go about their business and on their way? Talking about an infringement of liberty, right? So apparently there's no probable cause there for me to be cited or arrested, but yet my liberty is being interrupted. It's worse than that. That was from the data they were able to look at, reports, paperwork. But then they said, DOJ said, well, let's look at radio transmission. So they did a sampling of the CAD system, radio transmission. And they realized something. Wow, it's not 300,000 stops. It's seven times greater. You see, because the police weren't generating paperwork. They're saying, yo, come here. What you got in your pocket? Boom, boom, boom. Sit down on a curb, up against the wall. You know how it goes. Seven times greater.
mathematicians in here? I know we got some engineers in here. I'll help you out. Because I know you've had a few.
2.1 million. 2.1 million stops in this 4.5 year period. But understand something. The number of tickets or arrests being made, that number remains the same at 3.7 of the 300,000. So what's that real number?
0.5%.
Say it? 0.5%. You got it, man. 0.5% of 2.1 million stops. Folks, that's a big problem. Now, when I give this example of Baltimore City, that's just an investigation that has taken place, given us a sampling of what's happening around the country. You go anywhere in the country and we're having this issue. We, the police, spend more time enforcing these failed drug laws than any other police business we do. Imagine this. So, I know that, you know, where did I see this? Here we go. Second paragraph on the back. For those of you who haven't read this, that was totally funny. It says that the Libertarian Party's platform is based on the moral principle of self-ownership. I can agree with that. Each individual has the right to control his or her own body, action, speech, and property. I can agree with that. And government's only role should be to help individuals defend themselves from force or fraud. Let me tell you something, folks. In these drug laws, the government is force. It's protecting us from force. In many cases, they are forced. Disclaimer that I forgot to give you guys. When I talk about anything political, when I get into talking about politics, that's not part of Leap's message that's coming from me, Neil Franklin. Okay? Because I might start talking a little bit about politics. I'm not a libertarian. I'm not a registered libertarian. I'm a Republican. Figure I'd pause a little bit. Let me take a sip of coffee just to give you a little time.
Not a libertarian, yeah.
With libertarian leaning. Who knows? Maybe before the end of the night, who knows what can happen. What?
You were going after drugs for 34 years,
so you
want to see the light.
Touche. Touche. Good call there. I really, you know, for the past couple of years, I've kind of like been on the libertarian circuit. And I continue to learn more and more. I mean, Students for Liberty, I've spoken at a couple of their conferences. Last year, I spoke at the National Convention down in Orlando. I spoke at Freedom Fest out in Vegas. I don't know whose idea it was, Freedom Fest in Vegas in the middle of July. But then when I think about it, it's a good idea, because no one wants to be outside, so you're going to be inside, right? It's a good idea. You know, here, I've done a lot of work with Eric down in Annapolis. Really hardworking guy. He's a hardworking dude. Some of you I've met and I'm familiar with. So I'm going to think really, really hard about a party change. I'm just throwing this in here a little bit. I'm going to think really, really hard about a party change when I leave here. As it relates to this issue, again, this topic of drug policy and ending the war on drugs and moving to a place that is self-centered, as it relates to drug use,
and in many other cases. See, we don't just arrest people for using drugs, the drugs that we don't like, you know, or maybe others don't like. We have a similar situation with the mentally ill. You know, we arrest and incarcerate a lot of people who are dealing with mental health issues. And many of them are veterans. And we haven't gotten to this place yet that we need to be of truly evaluating a person and their circumstances when we're about to place handcuffs on them. You mentioned earlier, you were talking about bail reform. Here's another problem that I have with liberty and these policies, criminal justice. And I advise, go to our website. We put together a new website in January when we came out with our name change and so on, because we broadened our platform. And when you go to our website, you're going to see five basic silos. You're going to see police community relations, and all of these things are attached to the war on drugs. Police community relations. You're going to see incarceration. You're going to see a silo of, yes, drug policy. You're going to see one of harm reduction, mainly as it relates to the mentally ill and drug abuse. And you're going to see one for global issues. And then under each of these silos, we break it down even more into different positions for different things. Bail reform is one of those. You know, I thought bail, you know, monetary bail, I thought that was about the safety of the community and to ensure that someone appears for trial. But the most important one is the safety of the community. But just about everyone who's arrested, especially in our major cities, there is a financial bail attached to it. That's another big problem we have with liberty. Supposed to be innocent until proven guilty. I mean, there were some great comments up here earlier about how people are literally forced to plea out. And heaven forbid you want a jury trial, which is your damn right. Because if you want a jury trial, and they convict you? Well, here's what the prosecutor says. Here's what we're offering you. We're offering you 2 years, you know, this much time probation, you know, blah, 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 for this charge or whatever. Take it or leave it. Like it was said earlier, did you hear that? I could probably beat this because I'm innocent, right?
Yeah,
but
the problem is that they don't just charge you on charge. You're going to have 5 or 6 charges before you ever go up.
Right. So they pile them on, and then they say, this is what we're offering you. But if you take it to trial before a jury, you know, again, what our Constitution is all about, you know, what the Bill of Rights is all about, what your rights are all about, you take it to trial, and you lose, we're going to hit you with the 20. And this charge and that charge, and they scare the crap out of people. You know, poor representation, if any representation whatsoever. And again, you know, this is for the average Joe who doesn't have the money for these high-powered attorneys. That's not right. And we're seeing a lot of this, again, attached to, again, the war on drugs and these drug policies. You know, charging people with conspiracy and this and that and the other. The list is long for how the war on drugs, war on people, affects, diminishes greatly our liberties in this country. Other countries get it. Other countries have turned the corner, have moved to a health-centered approach, moving away quickly from a criminal justice approach. Removing the stigma of both being morally bankrupt and being a criminal. And they're making headway, making a difference. And I'll begin to wrap up on this for a couple of examples. Well, one in particular, and that is Portugal. 14 years ago, Portugal decided enough is enough of how the United States does it. We're going to
decriminalized personal possession for all drugs. It's no longer a criminal offense. For 10 days supply. Now, they didn't put a hard number on it like we tend to do, 10 grams, you know, an ounce, or this, that, and the other. They said a 10-day supply for personal use. Why did they do that? Because people have different tolerance levels. So 10 days for you, it's going to be different than 10 days for me. But when you're caught with it, you go before a panel of medical folks, and they decide, first, are you addicted or are you not? Because most people, by far and large, 80-something percent, I believe it is, are just casual users of these horrible drugs. And there's a very small percentage of folks who end up with an addiction. That's the first thing they decide. So if you're not, they say, yeah, watch your use, but go. You don't end up in jail. If they find out that you have an addiction, then they give you the medical help that you need. And they can afford it because they have more than enough money, because they're not housing people for $35,000 to $50,000 a year in prison. And it only takes a small portion of that to treat someone effectively, to treat the entire person, not just the addiction. You have to treat the entire person and the issues that they're dealing with. Job training, health, and other things, education. Here's the result. Now, they did this 14 years ago. A 71% reduction in new cases of HIV for intravenous drug users. That's a lot of lives being saved. 71. And you know what? It's not just a lot of lives being saved, it's a lot of money being saved when you're not suffering from HIV and you have to go get treated, right? A 52% reduction in overdose deaths. How many people are dying? How many people died last year in Maryland from overdoses?
I can tell you, Cecil County saw 92 overdoses just in the month of January.
This will be close to 50 lives being saved in just Cecil County in that short period of time. Tens of thousands of lives being saved across this country if we were to do that. But what about the young people? Before I give you those numbers, let me ask you this. If meth, heroin, or cocaine were legal tomorrow, how many of you folks would use it? Would go out and start using it? I know you don't want to raise your hand. I know. I just thought I'd throw that out there.
Four
are at
the platform today.
Sure. So there's the thing. And it, you know, in a lot of these crowds, I mean, you guys really get this already, but, you know, sometimes I'm speaking to a room full of Republicans, and they're all like, what about the kids? And I ask that question. And, of course, they say, no, I wouldn't. Why are you so much smarter than the guy that's out in the parking lot, or the guy that's over here, or that person, or this person, or those other people? You really think you're that much smarter than them? And if they are that, well, if they are not quite as smart as you, you know what? They're probably already using it. Because it's not like they can't get it. It's very, very easy to get, as long as you have the cash, as long as you have the money. But you have no idea what you're buying, what you're getting. And that's why, with this fentanyl thing going on now, we have so many people dropping, because you have no idea what you're buying, what you're getting, how to use it. And there's some more stuff coming into the market now that's far more potent than fentanyl, folks. So hold it, absolutely. So hold on to your seats, because we're nowhere near the end of this, or close, unless we change our policies. In Portugal, what about the kids? A 22 to 25% reduction in overall drug use among middle and high school kids. Why is it? I interviewed a 14-year-old girl from Portugal once, and I got it. It's on my phone, 3.5 minutes long. And she says, well, drugs are just ordinary. It's no big deal. She said twice a year, a medical practitioner, not a cop, a medical practitioner comes into the classroom and talks about all these drugs, tobacco, alcohol, heroin, cocaine, you name it, all of it.
Here's what it is.
A scientific approach. Here's what it is. Here's what it does to you. Here's why you don't want to use it. Blah, 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 and so on. And then they're educated. They know about it. No scare tactics. They just give them the facts about it. And I said, then what do you do? She said, well, we just decide. Well, we know it's not what we want to do. And I'm like, that's it? She said, yeah. She said, you give me good information, I'll make a good decision. The other part of that is, when you don't have a criminal justice system as we do that is extremely disruptive to the family unit, you see, because the best education for a child is not in school. It's in the home. From the moment they're born, before they even enter kindergarten or the first grade. That's the important time. Not that the other years aren't, but that's the important time. But when we have a criminal justice system that is arresting so many people, and I want to say this, because there is an issue with the application of these laws in the color of your skin. Here's the data. I don't talk about stuff unless I got data. Here's the data. If you are a white child, the number is this. 1 in 57, one out of every 57 white children have a parent or parents under the control of the criminal justice system. If you are a black child, that number is 1 in 9. 1 in 9. And again, the culprit here is the enforcement of our drug policy. So when you think about the immorality of these young black children, and that they're not able to pull themselves up and to do right and to do this and to do that and the other, think about the family unit. When you don't have a strong family unit, which doesn't necessarily always have to be a father and a mother, but you don't have that core nucleus, stable nucleus in the household. And I got a whole bunch of data about foster kids, no matter what color you are, but about foster kids. When you don't have that family structure, watch out. Watch out what happens with these kids. We need policies that support the family units in this country, that support a health-centered approach, that give people what they need to rebuild their families when they do come out of prison. You see, because if we don't do this, it's going to cost us in more ways than one. And finances is a big one, because we're going to pay. We're going to pay big time. But if we focus our policies on improving the families in this country so that we can embrace our children and teach our children what to use, what not to use, what to do, what not to do, how to say this, how not to say that, we're going to be a much better place. A much better place. And it's going to cost us a whole lot less in the long run. So as you move forward doing the work that you do, pay a lot of attention to these failed policies, and at every chance you get, do your part in changing. Hook up with Eric and do that work in Annapolis. We need people coming down there to testify on these pieces of legislation that need to get passed. I got a ton of stuff to say, and it would take me probably a week to stand and talk about each and every individual piece of policy and the things that we need to do. But I just wanted to give you a snapshot of what we're dealing with regarding the failed policies of the war on drugs. And if I have a few minutes, I'll take a few questions. That's up to you guys.
Mr. Franklin, we were in a state that was chairman run by the Democrats that talked to give it up civil liberties. In your discussions with the legislators, they couldn't even bring themselves to legislate legalize marijuana of any significant amounts or whatever. What are they saying? I know what the Republicans say. What did the Democrats say to you?
Unfortunately, like it was said earlier, we live in a state that does not have voter referendum. Okay, the only way we can get this through the Constitution and for the people to vote on it is through our legislative body, right? They have to pass a piece of legislation so that you guys can vote for it during the election. And it was also, you know, the two most important things for a politician, not just in this state, but across this country, is number one is getting elected. What's number two?
Re-elected.
Right, getting re-elected. Okay, term limit thing. So it's whatever they think. It's whatever they think, whatever message they think is going to be best for them to get elected, not cause them any problems or whatever. We have to lead our representatives in a state like Maryland where we don't have that option. It's a shame that we just can't, you know, get enough signatures. Like, so we have 8 states that have legalized for adult use. Every one of those 8 states have voter referendums. So you get the signatures, goes on the ballot, people vote for it, it gets passed. The Democratic Party in this state, I don't know what it's like to be a Democrat in this state. I do talk with a lot of them and speak with a lot of them. There is a lot of support for it. And then, you know, we get to the exact, oh, I support it, but that's just not the piece of policy for me. Because it doesn't do this, or it does this, or it says this. And then you go to the next one, well, I support, you know, and then you change the legislation, and then that person doesn't support it, and it's back and forth. A lot of it's playing games. Until the people, you know, amass enough and speak loudly enough about being tired of it and wanting to change, make the phone calls, write the letters, show up at their offices, schedule appointments with them, until they see that, and they count that. They count every phone call, they count every letter, every email, and when you do show up, that's even better. When they start seeing that, then they'll change. It's, the way they vote is not really about how they feel about a piece of policy. It's what they see coming from the people, for the most part. So we gotta get busy and start knocking on some doors and ringing some phones.
First of all, Mr. Franklin, thank you for an excellent presentation this evening. Also, since our host is thanks to our servers today.
Thank you.
I teach at a university which saw asset forfeiture in under Operation Equinox when federal, state, and local officials seized 3 fraternity houses worth an aggregate about $1 million, basically because the student was entrapped by an undercover cop. And this leads me to a point. One of the things that I despise most about the war on drugs is the hypocrisy that you have in many cases the children of the very wealthy, the very elite. As we had at the University of Virginia, the fraternity houses that were seized were those of the middle class, the places where evidently the really heavy drug use was going on. I mean, the stuff would not touch. Did you run into this in your experiences, basically where the politically privileged basically stepped around these laws in really ugly fashion, whereas the poor slob from downtown Baltimore, they go in for all day?
Let me give you a couple of quick examples. The first one, working drugs in a city like Baltimore. For those of you who are familiar with Baltimore, due north of downtown, you've got places like Roland Park. Big, you know, multi-million-dollar homes and so on. The first thing is that, despite your demographic, we all use and sell drugs at relatively the same rates. We do it differently among our different cultures and groups, but use and sell relatively the same rate. We know that if we took drug dogs up into Roland Park, as we can legally do, and just walk up and down the street scanning cars, we're going to find dope. We're going to find a lot of dope. Has that ever been done once? No. And it never will be done because of the political power that Roland Park has and money that they have. And we will do it anywhere else. Let's look at our private school system versus our public school system. What happens when a kid in public school is found with a little bit of weed? click, click. What happens in a private school when a kid is found with an ounce of coke? What's left that they don't use? No, but it's handled administratively. At most, the kid might not be welcome back to that school. At most. Depends on how influential or how much money the parent has donated to the school. Different, you know, see, a big part of this is really about social class. If you've got the money, you're good to go. If you don't have the money, you're in big trouble. Even when you get into our universities at that level. I was the head of the Northeast region for the Bureau of Drug and Criminal Enforcement for a couple of years in the state of Maryland. We have a lot of universities in that area, and I can't remember ever sending undercover, you know, troopers onto any of these campuses. You know, never ever will that happen on some private campus, Loyola, you know, schools like that, Villa Julie and some other Notre Dame. But the University of Maryland Eastern Shore, which is a HBCU, basically an African American historical college, and I kicked myself. Actually, I was speaking to, well, let me start here. I sent a young black trooper fresh out of the academy onto that campus. I got a request. It was politically motivated to send someone down there, and I sent this young guy down there to work the campus, to go down there and buy drugs and lock people up. We've got a big drug problem down there on the University of Maryland Eastern Shore. After a few months, all said and done, bought a little bit of weed. A little bit of weed. And I was speaking to he's now a sergeant with another police agency. I was speaking to this guy, Johnny Brown, just about a week and a half ago about that case and how it gets me here to have done that. And again, because I didn't know what I know now, we've really got to start teaching our law enforcement folks at every level about the failures of these policies, about what it does to community and so on, at least though they had the knowledge. But, so you're right. We've got a big class issue with these policies that are very problematic.
What's your organization? Have you taken any action on Maryland
The question is, what is our organization's response or position on methadone and the money that's being generated, being made from these methadone clinics? We haven't really, I personally know it's a problem. I personally know that even beyond that, a lot of these drug treatment programs are very, very profitable. And they're like in the box, you know, 4-week programs, 12-week programs, same program for everybody. That crap doesn't work. But a lot of people are making a lot of money off of that. See, a lot of money is being made off of so many parts of this war on drugs. That's another reason why it's very difficult to undo. If you really want to help someone overcome their addiction to drugs, you've got to treat the entire person, which even goes beyond that physical person into their households, into their environment. But you got to deal with their other health issues. You got to deal with job training, job placement, education. You got to look at the whole person. Trauma, you know, they might be self. A lot of people are self-medicating for a number of different reasons. And I'll take one more question. I guess you're the big winner.
Neil, can you talk a little bit more about Portugal? You indicated that they had legalized possession, but did they legalize distribution? And if so, has that not yet resulted in more people using?
So, because of the United Nations Treaty on Narcotic Drugs, no country has legalized yet. Other than the United States,
of these drugs, marijuana, cocaine, you know, the ones we have legal, has legalized distribution outside of a medical approach. So it's still illegal in Portugal to sell these drugs. But what has happened is you're shrinking that market, because now people are coming in, you remove the stigma, people are coming in, I had a problem. So they start seeing the numbers go up for treatment, because now people feel comfortable in coming forward. So now when you're properly treating people, the entire person, the dependency, you know, that end user, that number goes down. The demand goes down. When the demand goes down, the market shrinks. You know, so there are a number of ways that we in this country can begin this process in looking at what other countries are doing, but heaven forbid us if we follow another country's lead. We have to lead. That seems to be the mindset here. I'm all for the United States, USA. But when it gets to a point that we can't follow someone else's lead, that's very, very problematic. If it's going to end up saving lives and saving us so much, we need to begin looking at other countries and learning what works and following their lead. And we just have a problem following other folks. But
age restriction.
Mm-hmm.
For
the children, like at what age is it legal to or not to? Age. Well, what we say is...
I see one word, age.
18?
No pressure.
16?
21?
Not that easy. Not that easy. Because if you... Here's the thing. It should be up to the individual states to establish what policy works best for them. That's what this country is all about. The individual states and the rights of the states. So, just like with alcohol... You know, you establish at the state level what that means to be.
Thank you.